Director of Custom Programs for Addiction Professional. Thank you all so much for joining us today. We have a great recovery community here in Denver, and we're glad to be a part of it. Today's topic is self-care for therapists, strategies, techniques, and ethics. And we have a very impressive panel of experts waiting to weigh in. Before we get started, a few housekeeping notes that they made me read. So, today's program is eligible for one continuing education credit. You should have received a certificate of participation upon arrival. If not, please visit the registration desk and make sure to email you one. Please complete the evaluation form that you found at your place setting. This allows us to continue to offer continuing education credit. It also allows us to improve and keep producing great programs. For those of you who registered in advance, you should have received a $25 gift card on your way in. If not, please check the registration table. In deference to our sponsors today, please refrain from passing out any promotional materials. And for those of you who tweet, are there any tweeters out there? Any? Oh, there's one. Thank you, Casey. The hashtag for today's event is AP Series, all in one. Today's event is made possible by five sponsors who are outstanding supporters of the recovery community. Dominion Diagnostics is our 2016 Panel Series Thought Leadership Partner, and Foundations Recovery Network is one of our 2016 Panel Series sponsors. Both are supporting this educational series in cities across the country. Today's program is also sponsored by Decision Point Center, CEDAR, and Valley Hope Association, as well as our promotional partner, ICNRC. Now it's my pleasure to introduce our panelists. Diana Sandoval joins us today courtesy of Dominion Diagnostics. She is the Clinical Director for Sandstone Care and the Owner and Clinical Director of Tandem Wellness Center. Diana has been a licensed professional counselor and state-certified addictions counselor for over 20 years. She has provided faith-based counseling and coaching in a variety of client populations and has worked in residential, correctional, military, and outpatient programs, providing mental health and substance abuse services. Luke, Justin, would you like to say a few words about Dominion? Just look in the back.
Dominion Diagnostics was happy to support the recovery community. We're urine drug testing and blood testing in the lab that's focused on treatment for the last 20 years. One thing I did want to say that about 2.5 or 3 years ago, at this event, actually, a therapist group was started. We call them Family Rock Stars. There's a bunch of those folks in here. And if anyone who's not part of that group is interested, contact me at the end of the event. We'll put you on the distribution list. But essentially what it is, we meet once a month, talk about a variety of topics. It's no charge to you, lunch is provided. We have a whole range of interesting treatment topics. And in addition, Valerie Schimbaum is one of our members. She's right in the ring, Valerie. She has now started an additional group that meets on the north side of Denver. The original one meets in Aurora, hopefully, but Valerie, I don't know if you want to say anything about it.
In addition to Family Rockstars Networking Group, there's another opportunity to network with clinicians on both sides of town. We are the mental health professionals in private practice. There's no cost to join, and we meet 6 times a year in the tech center and 6 times a year now in North Bend. We have a variety of speakers, case consult, how to speak at a conference, how to write a book, you know, all kinds of different things. So if you're interested in joining the group, please feel free to see me, and I will get you on the list and get you started. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Luke and Dominion, for your support. Gary Heese is the Vice President of Professional Relations at Decision Point Center. He has worked in a variety of treatment settings, including working with adolescents in an alternative education program, with adult co-occurring disorder clinics, clients in a community mental health setting that included hospitals, and at a partial hospital program in outpatient therapy in a private therapeutic boarding school, and a private therapeutic boarding school, say that 3 times fast, for adolescent women. Gary's experience includes a wealth of treatment modalities and therapeutic strategies. Gary, will you tell us a bit about Decision Point?
You bet.
You don't have to stand up, everybody can see you.
That's all right. My name is Gary Heese. I'm trained as an MFT. I'm licensed as an LPC. Coming upon 27 years of recovery in AA, Decision Point Center, we decided to make a tremendous shift. 1 year ago, practically today. Paul Octerlone came on board as our CEO. I had been waiting for an opportunity to put together a truly clinical program addressing substance use disorders. So what we do, the things that we do are that are really stand out and unique is all of our programs are JACO accredited, including our wholly owned medical detox. We look at substance use disorders as always being coupled with developmental deficits, particularly Erickson's fifth stage of development, the development of ego identity. In that regard, we look at failure to launch, and the skills are good. Don't get me wrong. It's good to teach how to balance a checkbook, how to interview for a job, how to write a resume. But the key to failure to launch is the failure to develop strong ego identity, and from that derive a purpose in life, and then drive toward that purpose. So with the young people we work with, we work with them in a collaborative and non-shaming manner. If you are looking for a treatment center that says put a plug in the jug, you're nothing but an addict, get in the van and go to a 12-step meeting, we're not it. We will support anyone having any kind of support network that works for them. If they want Celebrate Recovery, Smart Recovery, if they want to do Patrick Carnes Gentle Path, if they like AA, all of those work for us. That's not the debate we're going to have while they're paying for treatment. Instead, we're going to work on helping them identify who they are, and from that, where they'd like to go in life, and recognize the fact that that passion is more valuable than using substances. So that's what we do. I've waited 20 years to be able to put a program like that in place. So I'm formerly the clinical director, and we have it in place now. We're very, very excited about it. I caught a few slings and arrows at the West Coast Symposium last week, but that's all right. You guys take care.
Thank you, Gary. Meredith Baldrige is the behavioral health supervisor with Women's Residential Programs at CEDAR. She has worked in the field of addiction and co-occurring disorders treatment for 25 years. Meredith has been sought after for consultation in numerous behavioral health care settings that are working towards integrating mental health and trauma-informed care into their practice. She specializes in program development and staff training. Allison, can you tell us a few things about CEDAR?
Hi, everyone. Thank you so much. I'm Allison Hardy, and I do community outreach for CEDAR. And I want to give a plug for NCAP, which is coming to Denver for the first time, right, in August. We're so excited that it's coming to town. I hope you'll all take a look at the agenda, because it hasn't been here before, and we're pleased to have them down here. I also want to give a shout-out to Dominion's Rockstars. CEDAR, our family therapists have been a part of the Rockstars since they started, and we get so much great networking done with that group. So please take a look at that. CEDAR, hopefully many of you know about us. We're having our 10th anniversary this year. We're out at Ann Schutz Medical Campus, part of the University of Colorado Hospital. 50 primary residential beds. We have 20 of the men's and 20 of the women's. Meredith heads up the women's program. We are this year launching a campaign to get more women into treatment. That's one of our hurdles, so really are going to take that on this year. I'm tired of seeing the cottage and the men's sky full, and the women's still has 10 more beds available. So we've got outpatient, we've got addiction medicine, psychiatry, psychologists, so we have a multi-team. There's 11 on every patient's care team, between spiritual care, family care, a case manager, all those doctors I just mentioned. So please, if you haven't been out to CEDAR, would like a tour, let me know. That's my job. I do tours every week. So thanks to Addiction Professional Magazine and Vendo.
Thank you. Last but not least, Stacey Delva is the program director at Valley Hope of Parker. She began her career in the addiction field in 2001 and has worked in counseling, utilization review, admissions, business management, and program management, always with a focus on helping her clients on their journey toward long-term recovery. Liz, would you like to say a few words about Valley Hope Association?
Sure. So for those of you who aren't familiar with Valley Hope, we are a nonprofit organization. We were founded in 1967 in North Kansas. We're still headquartered today, and since then we've grown to be in 7 states. We have 16 facilities and we offer 18 programs. The one thing that I find really unique about us is that we do offer online treatment. It's an access track. We have intensive outpatient as well as continuing care on there. And we've been able to make treatment a little bit more accessible for those who can't always be in the same place 3 times a week. We are 12-step based, and with that, we're really rooted in treating our patients with love and respect and just loving them until they can love themselves and setting them up on the best path to find long-term recovery.
Thank you. And would you like to say a few words about Sandstone?
Yeah.
Yes.
Please.
Absolutely. Thank you.
Hello, everybody. I am Wesley Hooks. I'm with Sandstone Care, a new organization that just opened the doors in October. For those of you who don't know what Sandstone is, we offer a full continuum of outpatient services for adolescents and young adults 13 to 17 and 18 to 26. We pride ourselves on, through a therapeutic approach, we take a systemic approach to care. So that allows us to not only treat the individual, but the environment as well. We have an incredibly well-rounded team. Very proud to be part of the Colorado community, helping others and fill that void and that gap where it's been such a dire need in this state for so long. So we're happy to be here, and I'm happy to support Diana wholeheartedly. So thank you, Peter.
Thank you. Meredith is feeling a little under the weather today and has a bit of laryngitis. So joining Meredith at her microphone is Casey Sugars. So they're going to tag team things just to give Meredith's voice a rest. And they work very closely together. And Meredith, you wanted to take us through a brief exercise before we got started.
So are these on now?
They are.
Okay, so let me like wave if you need me to get closer.
Yeah, go ahead and put your microphone closer.
So Casey can introduce herself, but we work together at CEDAR and have been putting together programming for the patients and to some extent for staff around wellness and body-mind connection. And so that's part of why I brought her here today, to help be my voice. And we are doers, not just talkers. And so you want to say something about yourself and give us a hand.
So I am an exercise physiologist, and I do the nutrition consults at CEDAR. And a lot of the work that Meredith was kind of describing was I like to try to kind of cultivate that good relationship with your food and with your body. And in that respect, since this is about self-care, we were thinking we would get you up and move a little bit, since we've already been sitting a little bit. We probably had a lot of meetings before this, so we're going to have everybody kind of stand up a little bit.
Well, I'm scared.
If you have room. Because it's just kind of nice if you lock your fingers, kind of lace your fingers in together and kind of pull your shoulder blades apart, and maybe do a little bit of neck hygiene where you just kind of look, do a deep nod, looking all the way down to your toes. And if you take a big breath in and do the same thing but behind you, so you can release those fingers behind you and then kind of open up your chest a little bit if your shoulders will allow. And then maybe here, do a big nod up. And after you've taken a little bit of a breath, maybe lean that ear over to one side, one shoulder. And maybe do a little dance to that self movement. Same thing on the other side. And we have a lot of time when we're at the computer, so I'll have you put a thumb down and wrap your other thumb on top. And this is going to be a little different for everybody, but just kind of pull up towards your nose a little bit, just as comfortable as your wrists will allow. Get a little bit of movement. Lubricate the joints a little bit. And then do the same thing on the other side. It's a little different for everyone. It may or may not feel moving. And then if you reverse it where your thumb is now facing outside, but it's close to your chest, and you kind of wrap your hand on it again, you can twist in the opposite direction. Should feel kind of nice if you've had some time to send me email this morning. And same thing on the other side.
I can do my micro stretches for those who sit on their phone.
Yeah, that's right. And if you have any room, maybe do like a little bit of a march if your clothes will allow. Maybe bend the knees up. or if it's a little bit easier for you, maybe visit ease behind you. Yeah, and maybe on the last one, you go ahead and have a seat back down. And then put your opposite hand on your other knee and do a little twist, look it over your shoulder and say hi to your neighbor.
There we go.
And then do it on the other side so you don't walk in circles when you get out of here. Right.
I could even do it. All right.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Casey. And now everybody's me-centered. Not me, actual me, but self-centered. I'm going to start with you, Casey, for our first question. What are the main sources of professional fatigue and loss of engagement among clinical professionals in the behavioral healthcare space?
Well, obviously, lack of self-care, I think, and taking care of yourself. You know, for me, I have to attend, you know, meetings because I'm in recovery, and that's my self-care. And I have to have good boundaries, so I would say probably poor boundaries. And, you know, something recently that I learned about is called vicarious trauma, and that's when you take on the trauma of somebody else. And I think that's huge in our field.
And Diana, what are some other, you know, causes of professional fatigue that you've seen?
I've seen a lot of isolation, especially for folks who are in private practice. They just sort of get consumed by the work they're doing and caring for others and not caring for themselves. I think another piece is the acuity of the clients that we're servicing now. They just continue to rise in terms of need and clinical expertise, and that takes a lot out. And then just a lack of work-life balance, permission to have work-life balance. We're in a caring field, so we often devote ourselves to others and then feel guilty about taking care of ourselves. So I think those things contribute.
Anyone else want to go in?
I would just add to that, not only the acuity, but at least in the area where I work, we've had, it's the opiate overdose epidemic has really taken a toll on a lot of my coworkers and certainly on me too, and we work with a lot of opiate addicts. And being able to figure out how to make an impact on that, and the recidivism rate along with that. So you don't see the fruits of your labor a lot of times when you see the people who are struggling instead.
And Gary?
Well, I tell you, when there's difficulty within the milieu, especially if a client leaves and then passes away, even when you're dealing with private practice, one of the first things we're really good at is calling everybody in. We do a grief group for all of our clients, and then we don't do a damn thing for our clinicians and for our staff. What we've got to begin doing is going ahead and taking responsibility and accountability for the mental health of our staff. It will be directly related to the mental health of our clients and therefore the quality of the service that we deliver. But a lot of us are not formally doing that. How many organizations have a policy and procedure in place that says when an event like that happens, after we take care of the clients, we'll take care of our staff? That needs to change.
Gary, you raised a couple of excellent points there. First, you know, what are some of the danger signs that professional fatigue might be setting in? What are things that clinicians can look for in themselves and in their coworkers? And I'll start off with you, Gary, please.
Yeah, grumpiness. Now, for some of the other gentlemen in the room, I mean, I'm 65 this year, we get to be grumpy. But when you see that kind of thing going on with a clinician, or if you see isolation at work, people not exchanging ideas, in private practice, not deliberately getting together with colleagues in a support network of your own where you can talk about cases with each other, beginning to have clients come up, one of the worst, guys, all of our nightmare, is you have a group of clients come to you and say, well, you know, the therapist just spent more time talking about himself than he did what's going on in Peru. I mean, that's a dead giveaway right there. All in all, my observation after being in the field a while is that for too doggone long, the field has used it as, well, you know, there'll be another batch of people coming out who need their supervision hours, so we'll just burn the clinician and we'll hire another one. And we need to stop that. Stability counts, not only for the clients, but long-term for the programs and the practices we represent.
So in addition to grouchiness, Diana, what are some of the other signs of that professional fatigue?
I think a lack of being solution-focused. I think clinicians kind of get into a rut and start doing things robotically and sort of lose that sense of human presence, and clients feel that. Clinicians feel that they're just going through the motions. Certainly documentation fails, groups are let out early, or clients are becoming a little bit more front and center than the therapist is, and clients oftentimes will take the lead in a group process, and the therapist melts in and begins to kind of look like a client in presence. So just a lack of presence. Yeah,
that's a great point. And down there at the end of the table, Team Cedar.
As far as characteristics go, our body gives us a lot of different symptoms and a lot of feedback, and I think it's very easy to disregard them. So if I'm going from meeting to meeting to meeting, or if I have patient after patient after patient, I might experience some fatigue. I might have some kind of digestive upset. And a lot of times we want to push through that, and so maybe treating that fatigue with a cup of coffee, or kind of not listening to that feedback that we get from our bodies would be probably a big characteristic of burnout.
So, you know, Diana mentioned that this is a very caring profession. So, Stacy, as a result of, you know, this caring, and, you know, you all give of yourselves, what ethical dilemmas do you find in the patient-client relationship that contribute to stress and professional fatigue?
I would say probably the number one thing would be talent transference. I see it happen often. I've experienced it myself. But to go back to, you know, one and two kind of go together. You know, if I'm not taking good care of myself and my mental health, then I am going to experience that. And I think part of good care is knowing when that's happening and knowing when you have to step away also. And that's a tough decision being a clinician, is to say, maybe I can't work with this individual, and giving passing it on to somebody else, and there's nothing wrong with that. So I would say the number one thing would be talent transference.
Anything else to add to that, Gary?
Yeah, good Lord, that's the definition of professionalism. We encourage our clinicians to, if they feel that they can't be effective, we encourage them to come, and that it's not going to be we're not going to make them wear a red letter or put a black mark in their personnel file if they need a client to be moved to somebody else because they feel like they're not being effective with it. The other source of stress that I've observed in the organizations I've been in is the conflict between admissions and clinical. Admissions often wants to bring in a patient that is above the acuity that we're really equipped to handle. And if clinical doesn't have significant input in that, for instance, when I was the clinical director at Decision Point, I had the last say as to who came into the milieu depending on acuity. There is nothing worse than everyone knowing, especially if their license is on the line, that a patient has been accepted that they're not really equipped to handle within their milieu.
Can I add something to that? Kind of the opposite, I would say, of countertransference is...
Go ahead and pull your mic a little bit closer.
So one of my concerns would be, in terms of ethical dilemmas, is when a counselor is so overwhelmed with their caseload, not just the individual, like you were saying, but and if not asking for supervision when they need it. So they just sort of retreat to their office and they're doing the basics of their charting and Maybe they continue their individual sessions with the patients or the clients, but they're not moving, they're not fully engaged in the treatment process, and they're not asking for help. And that's something that we spend so much time trying to convince the patients and the clients to do, to practice asking for help. Mm-hmm. And often as staff, I think that we don't do that, and that becomes a really serious issue if you're working with people who you can't actually properly serve, or you can't respond well to their stakeholders, whether it's the family members or the referents, because you're so fatigued that you can't respond, and then you're not asking for help. Mm-hmm.
So that's a great comment. So my question for you is, how and when should an organization approach the conversation with his or her or their clinician about the importance of self-care?
So I started in the interview process. I ask people when they're applying for a job how they take care of themselves, and I listen to that answer very carefully. Because if they're not already practicing something, that's a red flag for me. And I think in the interview process, people want to, sort of train to look like we'll do anything for the company. It's just out in the business world in general. And, a lot of us are codependent in our work and think that, self-sacrifice is what we're supposed to do. So I look for that in the actual interview. And also, I have interviewed potential employers about that same thing. What does the organization do to support the individual or the team, in the self-care process? And then I also think it's important that it comes up in supervision on a routine basis. So I supervise a team of people, and we have shift report every night, and it comes up in that, and it also comes up in individual supervision with the clinicians. So if you're doing that all along, then if you have to do a bigger intervention, it shouldn't come as a shock.
Diana, in your practice, how have you approached clinicians who really need to start focusing more on their self-care?
Much the way Meredith does, I think it's an immediate conversation. It has to happen. And for me, I supervise from a place of culture. I think it needs to be an organizational culture, that it's an expectation that people are taking care of themselves. I agree with what Gary said, that the quality of the wellness that our staff have is the quality of service that the clients will experience. And so for me as a clinical director, my caseload is the team. And so I'm always looking at how to be supportive of them, how to be encouraging of them, and to look at, are they properly trained? Are they equipped? Not just because they have experience in education as therapists, but are they equipped and ready to go into this workforce? And that includes balance. It includes permission. I think permission is a word we need to use amongst ourselves all the time. Permission to need counseling, permission to do mental health work, permission to be physically well, permission to, take care of ourselves and not be put off by the fact that, hey, I need a day off, I need a mental health day, and that's okay. So that's part of the dialogue, and it's a core cultural value in the organization.
How many of you have taken a mental health day in the last 6 months? Do you think that number needs to be higher?
Absolutely. Yes. I would like to see every hand in here. And I didn't raise mine. So I hope you all were paying attention until I pointed that out. But yeah, I absolutely think everyone needs that. There's a stigma, and I won't go on too long, but there's a stigma that for decades we've been trying to overcome in terms of people receiving mental health services as clients. But, I will tell you that it's been my experience that we as a collective professional team need to get rid of that stigma as well. There's this idea that because we're mental health experts, we somehow don't have any mental health needs. And I think that's just a really unkind approach to each other, that we need to allow each other permission to be well.
Well, you have homework.
Yeah, mental health day, everybody.
Gary, you mentioned that self-care should be really company policy.
Right.
Is it for you at your organization?
Absolutely. If we have someone who, for instance, our lead way to address trauma is EMDR. If we have a situation where someone closely related to a client is feeling that kind of stress, the company arranges for the contractor who does our EMDR to do that with our staff as well. We need to be able to do that. Otherwise, you're going to get all kinds of reactions. It's too doggone hard in this profession to get enough of your own work done to keep your baggage out of the session so that the session is about the client. I've asked people about their personal work, and my HR person goes crazy when I do that. But you know, to me, it's part of the qualifications. I don't want to know the dirt and the blood and the sand on the floor. I just want to know, have you done it? And are you doing it? And what's your philosophy on that? So yes, the organization's got to support it. The other thing your organization can do, and this is where, honest to God, I envy you guys in private practice, but I feel sorry for you too. A good clinical director and a good executive staff of a company is going to really work hard at developing a team feeling within the therapist, so that when a therapist notices that somebody is fatigued, that literally the culture says, hey, I'm doing okay today. It looks like you're doing a hard day. I'll take your group. Go decompress, where they take care of each other.
Yeah. That's a great example of a way that policy and activities can really encourage self-care at the organization level. Stacy, what are some other examples of policies or activities or just things that organizations can do to, I don't say mandate, but can make sure that people are practicing self-care?
Well, you know, I know at our organization, organizationally, we offer EAP assistance for our staff. We all get 12 sessions a year free. And, you know, to me, that is probably one of the most critical and important benefits that Valley Hope offers. At least it was for me. And I strongly encourage my staff to do that. I think group supervision is extremely important as well. We do that on a weekly basis. We get together and we have a lunch and learn and we eat lunch together. And I really do try to provide an environment where the staff can talk about it. You know, how they are taking care of themselves, and if they're not, why, and, you know, what do we need to do cohesively as a team to make sure that we're taking care of each other. I think that is so important, and we just talked about that this morning in our staff meeting, so, you know, the importance of taking care of each other. You know, if I'm exhausted, you know, hey, will you please step in and help me out? The other thing that organizationally is offered is our counselors get 4 weeks of vacation a year, and, you know, if somebody's feeling fatigued and stressed out, they call in and say, I need a day, and I'm okay with that, because they need to do that for themselves. You know, the most important thing that I think for me is that we try to teach our patients self-care and the importance of, you know, what does that involve in recovery, and how are you going to do that when you leave treatment? If we're not doing that ourselves, then how are we going to provide that for our patients? I can't go home at night thinking I told my client to do this and I'm not doing it myself. So I think that's really important as well.
You brought up a great point about taking care of each other. We talked about how organizations can encourage self-care. But I'm going to address this question to you, Meredith and Casey, because I couldn't ask for a better example right now. But how can colleagues encourage one another to take care of themselves?
Well, so obviously I did that by bringing Casey with me today, though I'm not letting her talk, so I gotta work on that, I guess. Then, have you seen the show Saving Grace? Has anybody seen that? It's a very intense cop show. And one of the things I love about that show is they are always laughing. They have the most trauma-related job in the show, but they're always laughing together. And humor, I think, is one of the essential tools for taking care of ourselves in the workplace, in the moment. And so I've gotten to the point in my career where I kind of don't care if I make a bit of a fool of myself. That's why there's a picture of a goat in my bio picture. Because I just thought, besides animals, are, you know.
Yes, there is. There is a
goat. There is a goat. That baby goat made me happy. And animals are, you know, we're working on getting a therapy dog at Cedar. But I just think humor is absolutely essential, and I'd rather act wacky and have my team be laughing than be so serious that they can't loosen up around me. So that would be like my essential contribution.
I would also maybe add that we're on the go a lot. You know, we all are familiar with what our physiological response to stress is, and we're aware of what the physiological digestive process is, and they don't mix and mingle all that well. And so we find ourselves kind of running all day, running to help a patient or for these different obligations, that we're kind of in that chronically elevated stress response. So even whenever I'm sitting down to eat a meal, I'm not able to digest or assimilate that nutrition fully. So even encouraging your coworker to kind of slow down for a minute, if you're seeing that kind of manic kind of play out, to just have a dialogue around it and offer to step in, or just to recommend to slow down. It has so much to do with the way that we feel and what we're able to give to patients.
Diana, any other suggestions for helping our colleagues, you know, prevent burnout?
Yeah, you know, it echoes what you've been hearing, but one of the things, excuse me, that we do is, again, we create a culture of vulnerability. Like, it's okay to be honest about who you are and where you are and ask for help, and that's an acceptable condition, but we counter that also with fun. We had all of our staff were kind of stressed out, folks that had kids, they were getting out of school, they were doing field days. So we took a Friday and we had a field day at Wash Park. And we did three-legged races and we had t-shirts and prizes and all that kind of stuff, yeah. And so we really recognize that to laugh, to be together, to be cohesive, it takes quality and quantity time, and it can't always be about the work. We know when we have to focus and get that job done, but we also know when we can let go and just be people connecting and having fun and being together. And we do the same thing. We tag team. You know, we've eliminated roles or titles. Like, everybody knows that they have the circumference of duties that need to be done. But if you can't find me in my office, in the clinical director office, I'm probably collecting UAs, or, you know, running a group or doing whatever needs to be done. And so that is really about creating cohesion and having fun and working together.
Can I add something?
Please.
I'm just sitting here thinking, you know, I'm being both sides of the fence, you know, being a counselor for many, many years, and now being in a leadership role, the one thing that I have learned in this very short time is staff appreciation. And I think that we don't do that enough, at least for me, I'm speaking for myself, is to remind myself what it was like to be on that side of the fence, and what it was like when somebody told me what a great job I was doing, that gave me the energy and the strength to come back the next day and work that much harder for the people that I was working with. And I just feel like that goes such a long way when your supervisor recognizes how hard this job is. So emotionally draining. I mean, to care for others takes a lot of emotion, right? And so I think to remind, you know, for me, I have to remind myself how important it is for me to let the people that I work with and that work with me, how important they are to me, that I can't do any of this without them. And for them to know that what they do every single day and they come back and do it again is very much appreciated.
So, you know, everybody in this audience is very well educated. You know, that it requires, you know, a lot of degrees to work in this field. With that education comes a large financial commitment. You know, private company student loans. You know, there are a lot of financial stresses in the world. There are lots of other stresses. We've talked about stress from within the workplace, but how can, you know, organizations address some of those stresses from outside the workplace that could help help prevent burnout? And Gary, I'll start with you.
Oh, gosh. I'm not very good at political correctness, as y'all can probably tell. Decent compensation. Decent compensation. You're talking about somebody who is working in a professional field who has 7 years of education. The other people who have 7 years of education are more doctors and lawyers. The compensation has to be commensurate. Two, we have to change the philosophy, especially, and sometimes I'm saying this in a biased fashion, especially in the world of treatment. We need to internally begin to enforce that people who have 6 months of recovery on board and who drove the van last week are not qualified to run a group. We need to stop that trend within the industry. We need to accept that if we are going to do things at a clinical level, then we need to pay quality people decent compensation, and that we need to go for longevity and therefore stability in our organization. All of us talk about it's so difficult to maintain a culture. Well, yes, if people are coming and going constantly, it is. So that's one of the main things that I can think of right there.
Diana, is that
the way
as well?
I just echo that. I mean, I wrote on the paper competitive salaries. I'm always looking at, you know, regional as well as local salary comparisons for positions. If people can live on what they're bringing home, they have a much more stable mindset. We look at that heavily. And make sure, like Gary said, I think we have been undervalued as a profession for many, 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 many years. And I think it's about rising up now and getting to a point where we say we really are deserving of this level of compensation and being willing to ask for that. So we are careful about our salary range for staff, and we want longevity. We don't want turnover. And we want people happy and committed.
So it looks like the restaurants are going to push us along here, so I'm going to wrap it up with just a couple more questions. Mm-hmm. You know, and I'll start with you, Gary. What's one action across the entire field of addiction treatment and behavioral health care could have the greatest impact on improving counselors and clinicians' work experience?
Oh gosh, a corporate mindset that says that the work that those people do and the work that the staff does is exceedingly valuable. That it's not about what can we bill for today, it's about, oh my God, we're engaged in the business of saving lives.
Stacy?
You know, I think a couple of things, several things come to mind for me. You know, increase staffing, increase salaries to reduce turnover, reduce workload, and required documentation. I just think caring more about the people that are doing the work every single day is most important. Appreciation, like I said earlier. I think for our organization, I know that we are currently looking at changing our salary requirements, you know, our salary range, because, you know, it's time. We're moving into a really ever-changing future, and I think that's going to be a big part of it. So, and I think it'll help reduce turnover and increase longevity, I think.
And Meredith?
I think in terms of the industry, there are two areas that I would love to see more focus on. One is our relationship with insurance companies. Yeah, so we've had multiple people comment on pay scales and staffing patterns. And I think one of the biggest drains for people is the amount of time and energy people have to, the clinicians have to spend documenting in a very specific way in order to get the insurance companies to deny the services we're asking for. And I've dealt with insurance companies for 25 years, and I think our field needs to become political in this area, because the concept of mental health parity doesn't actually exist in terms of practicality. It's not something that I'm seeing lived out. Insurance companies deny just random people who are going to die if they are in treatment. It's a very serious thing, and I'm not a political person, but I do think that we need to rally in this case and have a much louder voice, ironically coming from me right now. The other part is in terms of education. I think that we don't train our counselors, first of all, to be really sensitive to self-disclosure and how much we share. I mean, the field of addiction comes out of a grassroots, it takes money, no one kind of mentality. But that is not what a good clinician does. A good clinician does not use their story in order to help their client heal. That's what we do in a self-help setting. And so I think in education, we really need to train people to be more open to the idea of, I deserve help too, and I don't get it by sharing my story with my clients.
So do you have any questions from the audience before we wrap things up? Your Deacon himself.
I would love to add one quick thing about, you know, education and the financial stressors. You know, the one thing that I really appreciate about Valley Hope is that they have helped pay for my education in terms of tuition reimbursement, and I think that should be an expectation for all organizations to reduce the stress of the clinicians as well. I just wanted to add that.
Any questions from our audience? Our panelists will be here through lunch, so I encourage you to seek them out. They all have so much great information to contribute to conversation. If you did enjoy today's presentation, I do hope you'll join us at the National Conference on Addiction Disorders this August, right here in Denver. There, on the back of your badges, there is a discount code. So please do use it so that you can join us. I believe 15% off of our registration price. So we'd love to see you all there. Thank you very much to our sponsors, Dominion Diagnostics, Foundations Recovery Network, Valley Hope Association, Decision Point Center, and ICNRC. Thank you all very much.
Now they leave it here.